such a thought-provoking week. Thank you to all of you for your presentations. For those of you who are sticking around in Canada, it's not only Friday, it's the Friday before a long weekend. So thank you especially for sticking around. So I am a philosopher primarily. I also do some research in history of physics. My main research interests within philosophy are within foundations of quantum field theory, in particular, but not exclusively, issues raised by axiomatic approaches to quantum field theory. So what I'm going to be talking about is some areas in which I see some contact between issues that arise in that axiomatic context and some of the issues that have arisen this week. I'm also going to talk a little bit about the history of physics, as you can see. So to situate what I want to talk about, let me start with some questions that were raised for me by some of the talks that we heard this week. So one of the questions which keeps coming up in discussions and was raised in the talks is, how does one choose the axioms in the reconstruction projects? Clearly, we've seen different choices of axioms, but we've also seen conflicting choices of axioms, where Rob Speckens used the principle of identity of indiscernibles as an argument against a particular way of going, and Lee used the principle of identity of indiscernibles as a starting point for his formulation. So that is an illustration of how this can be a pressing question. In particular, I take it that the question that people are interested in is how physically insightful axioms can be distinguished between merely formal derivations of quantum theory from axioms which, so derivations that are formally correct, but from axioms that we don't think are physically insightful or illuminating. So a big question is how you decide what the difference is between those two types of scenarios. So another question, which I think is general to information theoretic approaches to foundations of the sort we've just been discussing all week, and this is one I'm going to tie into today, is the question of when we're dealing with two different physical theories, are we drawing formal analogies between the theories, are we trying to take a single physical theory and extend it to a new domain? Okay, so here's an example of, I think it's come up a number of times, but here's one point at which I think it may have come up, and I'll be interested, of course, I'm talking about other people's research, I'll be interested to hear what other people say in response to this. So Giulio gave a very interesting talk in which I take it that central to his approach to quantum thermodynamics was developing a formal analogy between entanglement theory, considered as a resource theory, and thermodynamics. So in particular, some of his central results concerned dualities between entanglement and purity, for example. So I take that to be part of what I'm thinking about as the formal analogy strategy. In contrast, David and Jonathan, when they set up their presentations of quantum thermodynamics, from the beginning, what they stressed was that they were trying to, I think, set up quantum thermodynamics as, in some ways, an extension of traditional thermodynamics. So in particular, there was a clear sense in which the domain of ordinary thermodynamics was trying to be was being extended to new types of quantum scenarios. So in particular, instead of looking at the thermodynamic limit, the focus was on quantum systems that behaved in particularly quantum kinds of ways. Okay, so this is something I'm going to be saying more about what I mean by formal analogy, but I wanted to tie in at the beginning so you can see how I think what I'm saying is related to some of the themes of the conference. I had other questions too, which we're not going to get to today. Sets of questions had to do with thinking about, from the perspective of quantum field theory, what happens to some of the results and derivations we heard about in the context of quantum field theory when you have an infinite number of degrees of freedom, when you have relativity. I think it's fairly clear that different senses of the term information are being used by in different contexts. I think it's interesting to think about whether they're related, whether they're incompatible, what the relationships are between the different senses in which this term is being used. But I'm not going to get to that today. Okay, so here's an outline of what I am going to get to. I'm going to start out by going back to an example in the history of physics to give you a nice, simple, concrete example of what I have in mind when I'm talking about formal analogies. And that's the case of Thomson starting out thinking about electrostatics and how to formulate the theory and taking as his point of departure Fourier's theory of heat. Then I'm going to jump to some derivations of quantum field theory from classical theories, which I think are interesting to think about in comparison and in contrast to the axiomatic presentations of ordinary quantum theory that we've heard this week. Then I will try to draw a few conclusions. All right, so starting with Thomson. Formal analogy. Here's a definition of formal analogy. And what I'm going to try and show is I'll give you a quick example, which shows that I think Thomson was thinking about electrostatics in relationship to heat in exactly this way. Definition of formal analogy from the literature. The one-to-one correspondence between different interpretations of the same formal, which here means uninterpreted theory. Okay, so another way of putting this is think of yourself as having a mathematical framework. A formal analogy is a case in which you have two different physical theories applying to two different domains in which you take the same mathematical framework, but you give it different physical interpretations in the two cases. Okay. An example, Thomson's early work on electrostatics, going back to 1842. So this is going back to when he was a 17-year-old. It was before he had even gone to Cambridge, to put it in context. It's also going back to a time when there was no such thing as electromagnetism yet. The theory of electricity was in a state in which there were lots of experimental results. In particular, Faraday had been actively experimenting and piling up a lot of interesting results. There were lots of different theories, which were partial theories that didn't account for all of these all these experimental results. And importantly, all these different theories had very different ideas about what kind of thing electricity was. So the theory of heat at the time, there were all different theories about what heat was. Most of them had something to do with heat being a fluid, right? Being caloric was one of the predominant theories at the time. Okay, so Thomson stepped into this situation. He wanted to further the theory of electricity. And so he took as his starting point of inspiration Fourier's theory of heat conduction, which was appealing to him because it was a way of dealing with the theory of heat and formulating the theory of heat, which tried to be independent of any sorts of controversial assumptions about what exactly heat was. Okay, so Fourier formulated his theory in terms of temperature and in terms of heat flux and quantities which were observable and which he didn't depend on particular ideas about fluids flowing around. Okay, so I think in some respects, Fourier's approach and Thomson's, the appeal it had to Thomson kind of echoes maybe operational approaches, part of what's appealing about operational approaches to quantum mechanics today, but we'll get to that in a little bit. Okay, so what did Thomson do with this? Well, he used the formal analogy between Fourier's theory of heat and electrostatics to draw the conclusion that it essentially is just the surface replacement theorem. Okay, so take any electrical source in a volume, you can replace that source by a set of electrical sources on this distributed in equilibrium on the surface of the volume. So you don't have to care about what's happening inside. Okay, so this was a theorem which, as we'll see, the analog of it was relatively straightforward to get from Fourier's theory of heat, but it was not at all obvious from the point of view of electrostatics, mostly because the mathematical theories of electrostatics were all theories of action at a distance at that point. Okay, so here is how Thompson proceeded by analogy. So his starting point was to notice that, okay, so on the left I have Fourier's theory of heat, F is obviously heat flux, T is temperature. On the right, I have electrostatics as it was being developed. So E is electrical force, and V is the potential, although it was a while before it was called the potential, but the mathematical term appeared. So what Thompson was looking at was, on the one side, he was looking at Poisson's equations for electrostatics, for electrostatic attraction between bodies at a distance. And so he noticed, for a case in which you're outside your electrical source, you obviously have Laplace equation. On the theory, he noticed that on the other side, in terms of Fourier's theory, you could get, first of all, the analogous relationship for flux and heat flux and temperature, as you could get for potential and electrical force. But more importantly, you could get a relationship which was you could get Laplace's equation in both cases. Okay, so what he needed in order to get to the result he wanted to in electricity was he needed to consider sources in the theory of heat. Okay, so this wasn't in something that Fourier didn't treat, but he noticed from the heat conservation equation that it was fairly straightforward to think about the analog of heat sources in the theory of heat, and of course this is all now familiar, but was new territory for Thompson. But he realized that if you have a isothermal surface and you're considering the temperature just outside the surface, then you don't have to care about what's happening inside the body because you have the continuity equation, you have the conservation equation. Okay, so here is the sort of picture you get once you're thinking about the theory of heat in terms of sources. So the little S's are your heat sources, which are distributed, so you have an isothermal surface, they're in equilibrium. Then you have your lines of flux and your isothermal surfaces at different temperatures. So what Thompson was excited about was that he could get the same picture for electrostatics. So he could have the same picture where you have the equilibrium charge distribution, you have your electrical lines of force, you have your potentials, so he was excited about that. Of course, thinking about this from the current perspective, you might think, okay, why is this so exciting? There's all sorts of theorems in vector calculus you could have just used to prove this very elementary result directly. In fact, it could have been done that way even in 1842, but the results were hidden in, at that point, obscure papers by Green and Gauss that Thompson was not yet aware of. So what he was doing was he was using this formal analogy between the two cases to draw a physical conclusion about electrostatics. Okay, so this is a nice clear example of a formal analogy. You see that there's exactly the same mathematical structure on both sides for both theories, and it's given a different physical interpretation in the two cases. The nice thing about Thompson is that he was trained as a natural philosopher. So he was very much, I think, he was conscious about the methodology he was using. And actually, what I showed you is actually one of the very first sustained uses of formal analogy in this way, of taking a mathematical framework without taking the physics from one domain and applying it in another domain. So he was very much aware and self-conscious about the kind of methodology he was using. And you can see here that this quote is just a couple years later, but that he's very much seeing himself as using what I'm calling a formal analogy. He says, when we find corresponding laws to be true for the phenomena presented by electrified bodies, we may make them the foundation of the mathematical theory of electricity. And this may be done if we consider them merely as actual truths without adopting any physical hypothesis. Although the idea they naturally suggest is that of the propagation of some effect by means of the mutual action of contiguous particles. Okay, so this was obviously the first step towards having a field theory. Just as Coulomb, although his laws naturally suggest the idea of material particles attracting or repelling one another at a distance, most carefully avoids making this a physical hypothesis and confines himself to the considerations of the mechanical effects which he observes and their necessary consequences. Okay, so what he's saying here is, I'm using a formal analogy. I have to be careful not to invest too much physical significance in this formal analogy. I don't think what I've got is a field theory yet. It's suggestive, but it's merely a formal analogy. I can use that mathematics to describe the effects, even though I don't know what the right physical interpretation for that formal analogy is. The interesting thing about Thompson is, of course, this is just the beginning of his life. He then picks up this project again later in his life, at which point Maxwell has expanded upon his idea of formal analogies, developed his electromagnetic theory, and then Thompson is returning to think about electromagnetism, and what he says is, I never satisfy myself until I make a mechanical model of a thing. If I can make a mechanical model, I can understand it. As long as I cannot make a mechanical model all the way through, I cannot understand. And that is why I cannot get the electromagnetic theory. I firmly believe in an electromagnetic theory of light, and that when we understand electricity, magnetism, and light, we shall see them all together as parts of a whole. But I want to understand light as well as I can without understanding things that we understand even less of. Okay, so actually I think parts of this quote have probably been uttered by different people in different contexts throughout the week. I think Thompson has in mind is making particular types of mechanical models, but analogous things could be said about the state of quantum mechanics today, which is interesting. Something similar came up in Gerhard's talk, colloquium talk yesterday, thinking about this kind of sentiment in electromagnetism as a motivation for thinking about the cellular automata models. Okay, so I think that there's some interesting parallels between where electromagnetism was at the end of the 19th century, before 1905, and where we are with quantum theory today. Okay, now I'm going to skip forward more than a century and make the connection with quantum field theory. As set up to give you an idea of where I'm going, I'm going to look at a derivation of quantum field theory that you get from a particular classical theory within the context of axiomatic quantum field theory. And what I'm going to suggest is that this is another use of formal analogy in contemporary quantum field theory that doesn't have exactly the same structure as the nice, very simple Faraday case or Thompson case that I gave you, but I think is in the same spirit of being a formal analogy rather than having some sort of a physical significance. So the question I want to ask here is, at least superficially, this seems to be something that's similar to what we've heard this week, and which is in the contemporary literature on reconstructing quantum theory, in that one of the focuses of that project is to think about the relationship between classical theories and quantum theories. So this is another context, a relativistic context, in which that's been done. Okay, so all right. So what's my context? So I'm going to be looking. This is not any. by any, this is not new research at all, I think it's good to have this sort of starting point in the back of your mind as a contrast kind of case. Okay, so I'm going to be looking at a particular axiomatization of quantum field theory that's been around for a long time, the Whiteman's axioms for quantum field theory, which are one of several axiomatizations. So this strategy for approaching quantum field theory goes back to the 50s, when in response to renormalization, which was a successful program empirically, but seemed somewhat mysterious, mathematically minded physicists decided to approach the problem by positing sets of axioms for quantum field theory, which were mathematically kosher, and then figuring out how where to go from there, right? And so the project was, think about quantum field theory in very general terms, don't think about particular systems, and then try afterwards to construct models for particular interacting systems. Okay, so the reason why it might be nice to think, I think it's nice to think about the algebraic axioms. In this case, it's going to turn out the Whiteman axioms are more useful. But the goal is going to be to find models of the axioms, which is going to be involve finding a well-defined set of fields, finding Hilbert space, finding a unitary representation for the Poincaré transformations, and finding a vacuum state. Okay. All right, so it turned out to be very hard to do this project, to find models for the axioms. One of the strategies which was successful, at least in the case of toy models, so here's the flag, everything I'm going to be talking about from this point on, from about model construction, is limited to certain special cases, certain toy models, but it, I think, is nonetheless illuminating. Okay, so one of the strategies which turned out to be useful was the strategy of Wick rotation, which we've heard about a few times this week. So that started out as being a strategy which was successfully used in the context of perturbative approaches to QED. I believe that Dyson was the first one to, at least in the energy frame rather than the time frame, to use this approach. And so the idea, as you know, is simply that you take your relativistic quantum field theory, you take your time coordinate, and then you take it to negative imaginary time. And so what this does is it takes you from a space-time in which you have Minkowski products, Lorentz four-vector products, into a space or space-time in which you have Euclidean four-vector products, which are much more well-behaved. And that turns out to be very useful if you're wanting to avoid divergences and if you're wanting to construct models. Okay, so this started out as being a useful mathematical trick. It was picked up in the 1960s by Schwinger in the 50s, who suggested that something more could be done with this rather than a simple mathematical trick like in the context of perturbation theory. And then Szymanczyk in the 60s was a proponent of developing a Euclidean field theory. And then it was picked up in the early 70s, and then that's where I'm going to leave the story off. But here's one of the places where it got picked up in the early 70s. Okay, so here's going to be the model construction strategy. So the idea is that you're going to start out with a set of Whiteman functions, which are a set of endpoint vacuum expectation values of your Minkowski fields, and you're going to Wick rotate them to get a set of what we'll call Schwinger functions at non-coincident points. So that's going to be to avoid the divergences. Okay, so then we're going to take these Schwinger functions, and instead of just treating them as set of functions, we're going to try to construct an entire theory out of these Schwinger functions. And so the way we're going to do that is we're going to use them to define a classical Euclidean field theory, which is really going to be a sort of probability theory, okay? Classical probability theory. So what you're going to have is your fields are going to be random variable value distributions. You're going to need a measure on this distribution space. And then remember, we're working in Euclidean space. So the x's are going to be points in Euclidean space. Okay, so here's part of the history. So this strategy actually was first proposed, I said, by Szymanczyk in the mid-60s. It took a while for it to be picked up within the axiomatic quantum field theory community as a strategy because it didn't seem like a promising strategy. So here's Barry Simon, who eventually was one of the people who contributed a lot to this work. But here's him reflecting many years later on what his thoughts were about the strategy. So he says, until Euclidean field theory changed my tune, I tended to think of probabilists as a priesthood who translated perfectly simple functional analytic ideas into a strange language that merely confused the uninitiated. Okay, so he clearly thinks this is not a promising direction to go in. Here's his description of what changed his mind. So he says, at Guerra's request, also made lots of contributions to this area, Arthur Whiteman set up a meeting with Lon Rosen and me in January 1972. Guerra began by listing on the blackboard what he was going to prove. It was as if he were from another planet. His first result was the linear lower bound that Ed Nelson and others had proven. All his other results, starting with the existence of the limits, were beyond anything that the then current technology could prove. I remember thinking to myself, yeah, sure, you're going to prove all that. Within 15 minutes, Guerra had explained his proofs of the results that I found impossible to believe. It was like a thunderbolt. Okay, so this just gives you the sense that this was a major technological innovation once people accepted that it was going to work, which was non-trivial. Okay, so the goal then is to have a strategy for constructing models. So how to proceed is to find a set of sufficient conditions on the set of Euclidean Schwinger functions or on the measures and fields, if you want, that guarantees that if you have a set of Schwinger functions satisfying those conditions, or if you have a set, if you have a proper measure and a set of fields satisfying the conditions, then you can analytically continue back to a set of Whiteman functions, which is guaranteed to be a model of the Whiteman axioms. Okay. So here is one route to doing that, known as the Osterwalder-Schrader axioms for Euclidean field theory. I'm not going to go into what they are, but the basic strategy is what's important here. So these are all conditions that you impose on, I think I've given the ones in terms of the measure and in terms of the set of fields. So what they showed, what they proved, was the reconstruction theorem, which is that if you find a set of Schwinger functions which satisfies these conditions, then you're going to they're going to analytically continue back to a Whiteman quantum field theory. Okay, so as I was saying, I think this is another example of the role that formal analogies have played in physics. So I think in the same way that Thomson used a formal analogy between theories of heat and electrostatics, here we have a formal analogy between this Euclidean field theory and the Whiteman quantum field theory. So one way I think in which you can see this is, how did Osterwalder and Schrader come up with their axioms? Well, they came up with axioms which were going to guarantee that their functions had the Schwinger functions had the properties, analytic properties, once they got analytically continued. Okay, so they were really inspired and following a formal strategy for coming up with their axioms in the first place. Okay, so it's non-trivial, of course, that there are such axioms that you can do this. But I think this is another example of a formal analogy. It isn't an example, however, that fits the definition I had before, the straightforward definition, because it's not the case here that you have one mathematical framework in which you can give two different physical interpretations, if you couldn't even physically interpret the Euclidean field theory, if that made sense. But I think it still, at least in spirit, is an example of a formal analogy strategy. Okay, so back to the interesting question for you folks. So by the light of contemporary reconstruction of quantum mechanics projects that we've been hearing about this week, does the Osterwalder-Schrader reconstruction theorem provide a physically insightful reconstruction of quantum field theory from Euclidean field theory? So I've already said my intuition is that no, it doesn't. I mean, it's very important in lots of respects, and that this is not what it was designed to do. But I think it's interesting to consider what makes this different than the other projects we've been hearing about this week. So one difference is that the reconstruction's only been carried out for toy models, as I was saying. So it's only been carried out for, obviously, free systems are fine, for interacting systems, for less than four dimensions, and not for gauge theories. I bracketed this, though, because I don't think that can be the reason why this is not in the spirit of the reconstruction projects we've heard about this week. Because we've heard a lot of cases of toy models, and hopefully in the Quantum Foundations community, we can appreciate that toy models give a lot of insight. I've also said that Euclidean field theory is not a real physical theory. Actually, this is kind of interesting because there are cases in which you can give it an interpretation of classical statistical mechanics. It's a variant of the Ising model for two-dimensional bosonic quantum fields. I'm not going to get into that, but so there are cases in which it seems to get a very good approximation, be able to be given a classical statistical mechanical interpretation. But I take it that actually trying to figure out the relationship between quantum theory and other theories that are not physical theories is part of the remit of the reconstruction project anyway. So I don't think that that's really an important point. Here's what I think is important. One of the goals I take it of at least some of the reconstruction projects is to come up with a new set of axioms for quantum mechanics which are better than the axioms that we have now, right? In the sense of providing more physical insight in some way. So if we think about that kind of criteria for what I've just given you, the description of the Osterwalder-Schrader axioms, I don't think anyone would jump up and say, oh, look, now we've found a better set of axioms for quantum field theory. Okay, so this is all at the level of intuition, but why not? Why would you not be willing to give up the Whiteman axioms and instead accept the Osterwalder-Schrader axioms? So I think a big part of it has to be that what you're doing is you're analytically continuing from your Minkowski space, and we think we want to quantum field theory want to be a relativistic theory, and then we're analytically continuing to Euclidean space, right? So Euclidean invariance was one of the axioms which was used in the Osterwalder-Schrader axioms. Okay, so I think that's one important reason why this axiomatization is not in the spirit of the reconstructions we've heard about this week. Here's another slightly different reason. And I hope I'm using the right terminology here. So by operational probability theory framework, maybe you could read that as general probability framework as well. But the idea, I take it, of the framework is that it's illuminating because you have one mathematical framework in which you can present axioms for both classical probability theory and quantum theory, right? So there's different sets of axioms, but there's one mathematical framework. So I think analytic continuation is obscuring the physical relationship between our Euclidean field theory and the quantum field theory in a way that you have and that's not happening in the reconstruction projects, at least that are within the general probability theory framework. The mathematical frameworks in which the Osterwalder-Schrader and Whiteman axioms get formulated are different. You could maybe disagree about that, and maybe two other people who've made huge contributions to this project might disagree with me here. So here's a quote from them. So Glim and Jaffe, the unity of mathematical structures for problems of diverse origin in physics should be no surprise. For classical physics, it is provided, for example, by a common mathematical formalism based on the wave equation and Laplace's equation. The unity transcends mathematical structure and encompasses basic phenomena as well. Okay, so if you read that as saying that the unity provided by mathematical structure goes beyond being merely a formal analogy and also has deep physical content, then I think they're disagreeing with me in classifying. This is the kind of project they have in mind, is the Osterwalder-Schrader axioms. And then they go on to say, thus particle physicists, nuclear physicists, and condensed matter physicists have considered similar scientific problems from complementary points of view. Okay, I think it might also be interesting to go back to think about how Fourier's, or sorry, how Thomson's project of formulating electrostatics compares with the modern reconstruction projects. One thing to note, I guess, is that Thomson was really engaging in a construction project because there was no such thing as electromagnetism yet to reconstruct. So that's an aside. But I think that there's an important difference here as well. So the operational probability theory framework characterizes theories using different sets of mathematical axioms, which you can present within the same mathematical framework. You see Fourier as instead, he's also using the same mathematical framework in both cases, but he's presenting the very same axioms for the two theories and then giving them different physical interpretations. So I think that's the point of the important point of contrast between Fourier's use of a formal analogy and what's happening in the modern reconstruction projects. Okay, so let me wrap up. So I think one moral that I wanted to get across is that the strategy of using formal analogies between theories on different domains, in particular the theory of heat, is a strategy which far predates quantum mechanics. It's not something that's special to quantum mechanics. I take it that one of the things we've been trying to do this week in various ways is trying to get at what's special about quantum mechanics. That's not one of the things. I've just argued that the Euclidean strategy for constructing models of Whiteman quantum field theories, my intuition tells me it's not in the same spirit as the reconstruction projects we've been hearing about this week. However, I have to put in the positive part here. I think that there's still some of the results that could be quite illuminating for people working on this project who are interested in how it might extend to quantum field theory. In particular, what I'd like to flag is that the formal relationship that you get when you Wick rotate is obviously based on relativity, right? You're taking the Minkowski structure and transforming it into Euclidean structure. So that's a clear point at which you're invoking relativity essentially. Finally, the big question I was asking at the beginning, how to go about distinguishing formal derivations, purely formal derivations, from physically insightful reconstructions of a theory. I think that thinking about historical case studies like the ones I've thought about might be a useful way of trying to flesh out one's intuitions more about what one is looking for in a physically insightful reconstruction. All right, thank you.
I want to certainly make a couple of remarks. I mean, I think what this clearly showed, this history, is the Whiteman and Osterwalder-Schrader axiomatization of field theory did not lead to such a thing as a development of the standard model. So it was clearly, what clearly had to be done in those days was making models. And Young-Mills theory in particular showed us the right way. That was the introduction of non-local gauge invariants, and that was totally missed by these people, that theory of local gauge invariants changes everything. In fact, I think if they would have continued their program, they would have been able to show that there exists practically no group theory at all. And I think there was a problem with quantum field theory, that people did reach that conclusion. You can't do quantum field theory, period. But that all that was before the discovery of non-invariant gauge invariants. Once you do that, everything changes, and now you can make models which are asymptotically free and where you unify different forces. And most of all, of course, the real world seems to be exactly like that. So the real world is it can be described very well by a model, but it's not easy to get such a model by trying to write down axioms. That's exactly the statement I made also yesterday in discussions making axioms is probably not the way to make progress. In spite of, well, I think on hindsight, once you have a complete theory, then you can ask, what are the axioms that make it all work? And my favorite example is, of course, Euclidean geometry by the Greeks. They raised that into the art, made axioms and it all worked beautifully. But that only after you've understood everything you can do that. But not before you've understood what the real truth is of the matter.
Right, and that, maybe that's also a good example, the Euclidean geometry example, because it was by trying to construct things, right, that progress was made.
Yeah, but it's still taught at school, you know, 2,000 years after they made those axioms, it still works. It's a beautiful way to understand mathematics or our geometry. But I like to look at the Greek way of handling space, not space time, but space, as a physical theory. I mean, it's of course a physical question. What happens if you measure 2 points? Can you figure out, or if you measure a triangle, what will the sum of the angles be? It was a discovery that sum of the angles equals 180 degrees all the time for every triangle, and they could build a beautiful theory explaining that. And that was Euclidean axiomatic geometry. So that was great, but you can only do that once you've understood how to do it. But axioms are very rarely going to help you any further in understanding how the physical world looks.
Any other questions, comments? So at the end of your talk, you were contrasting the project of sort of seeing a mathematical analogy, but having different physical interpretations with the axiomatization program. But I presume you mentioned earlier in your talk, Giulio's talk, and I see a strong analogy between that and what happens in the modern work on resource theories. So, you know, people in the quantum information community became very familiar with the resource theory of entanglement and a lot of its features. And then many people started abstracting those features and just finding, you know, the most abstract structure that could describe them, and then seeing those same structures in other resource theories, like resources of, you know, things that are out of thermal equilibrium or things that are not symmetric. So ideas like catalysis and all that stuff. So I do you agree that that is a strong analogy?
I'm glad to hear you say that, right? Because that's what I was thinking at the beginning, right? That the best kind of contrast I could pick out this week, there was a clear contrast between what I was taking to be a formal analogy strategy and extending one theory to a new domain was that example of Giulio's use of entanglement theory. I take it you were using it as a formal analogy, and then in much the same way that that Thompson was proceeding, using it to develop a theory of quantum thermodynamics. So when I was making my comments at the end, I was thinking more about reconstructions of quantum theory by itself.
So I think that idea does feature into the axiomatic program in some way. So if you look at Kuka's work, for example, on, you know, using symmetric monodal categories as a framework for describing process theories, I mean, he notes that, you know, compact structure in one of these symmetric monodal categories has many physical interpretations. You can interpret it in terms of entanglement, or in terms of classical correlation, or in some linguistic context. And the lesson he draws from that is that there's certain features of the quantum formalism that we should think of in a particular way, that they're not sort of unique to quantum theory. They're generic facts about composition. And so seeing that formal analogy with different physical interpretations teaches you not to think that this feature is somehow special to the context you're looking at, but rather sort of more abstract.
Okay, good. One of the things I think looking at the Thompson case and following it and seeing how Maxwell picked up the same strategy and how it was really helpful for him in arriving at electromagnetism really shows that the formal analogy strategy is a really fruitful strategy to use in physics, as long as you're careful about what you are getting out at the end, right? So the problem was, once they got to the end of the project, then if you were taking the models literally, then you were thinking there was an ether, right? And then there wasn't an ether. So it's a very useful strategy, or was a very useful strategy back then, for coming up with the mathematical framework. But then it was a less useful strategy because of this multiplicity of interpretations that the same mathematical framework could have, that it wasn't as useful for providing a physical interpretation.
But I think that multiplicity can be a feature rather than a bug.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And so I think that was and having those intuitions, right? So if you can't have one domain in which you have presumably any domain other than quantum theories, well, it gives you better intuitions about what was going on, right? So if you can translate the formalism of quantum mechanics into some other context where you have the same mathematical formalism, but you can have intuitions to go with it, then it seems like you're going to be able to make a lot better progress with figuring out how to introduce extensions of the formalism and how to take it to, and how to play with it, right?
There are some people who believe, or have believed at least, that the Euclidean formulation is the real physical one, that somehow we're really living in a Euclidean signature, but it somehow appears to us Lorentzian. Do you have any comment or insight on what's going on there?
Yeah, so actually, I was that's not something that I've thought about, but I'm iffy about that kind of motivation, right? Because about the sort of motivation I was giving of saying, look, we know that we want quantum field theory to be, we know that we want a Minkowski space theory, right? If you decided that a priori, then it seems like you've closed off a lot of other avenues. So this seems like a kind of weak reason to think about the one theory as being the physical theory and the other one is not. I mean, so the other, and so I think then the question gets raised, right? If you can push this beyond, as it has been pushed beyond sort of toy models, if you have two models that are genuinely empirically equivalent, is there really any difference between them at all, right? So one way of going would be to say the true theory is the Euclidean theory. Taking that a step farther would be there's no fact of the matter about whether the Minkowski space model is better or the Euclidean model is better. Do you have a feeling about
it? Like most people, I think what you said is right, that the Euclidean one is just a mathematical device to understand the Lorentzian model. But it does go beyond the toy model because it's used heavily for gauge theory and physically realistic theories.
Yeah.
But if you say that there is no fact of the matter, I don't quite understand that, because that would be like saying that any possible mathematical reformulation of a given formal framework is physically equivalent to the original framework.
Right, so I was thinking it'd be like something like absolute space in Newtonian theory, right? So there's no difference.
There you can't really. Yes.
Right, but maybe it's not quite as tight as an analogy in this case.
I just wanted to remark on these Osterwalder-Schrader axioms. So since I was like, geschließt du durch Osterwalder, so I know a little bit how this was.
Cool.
So it sounded a little bit as if this approach was not promising. I think like at the time it was a very promising approach and they tried to work out models. So they had something concrete in mind. But the problem is just it becomes so technically complicated, so the technical difficulties were overwhelming, and this is why didn't lead to up to the original promises.
Yeah, so I agree. I should say that there were lots of, and actually partial results have been obtained for gauge theories as well, right? Just not full, not everything you want. So it's an ongoing program. People are still working on it. My sense is that fewer people are working in this kind of Euclidean approach as they are on other more algebraic kind of inspired approaches these days. But yeah, it's a really hard mathematical problem, right? So it's a sort of problem. So if you can come up with a better set of axioms, right, or a better set of strategies, that would be great. But it's a hard problem.
So kind of in the direction you were just indicating, and kind of supplementing Rob's comments. There's a different way to axiomatize quantum field theory originating with Witten, Siegel, and so on in the 80s. And which in fact originated this mathematical field of topological quantum field theory and revolutionized knot theory and so on, and that at the same time brought these symmetric monoidal categories. And so there, this notion of composition that Rob already mentioned, in fact becomes a notion of composition in quantum field theory, in an axiomatization of quantum field theory. And it seems that that is a very fruitful way to do things in the sense that it connects with
what people here at this conference have been doing.
And sure, yeah, so, so I should, yeah.
What I've kind of talked about.
Yeah, and so, yeah, so I think there's, as far as I'm aware, there's not much contact between this kind of line and where it's gone and topological quantum field theory. But there are alternative ways, as I was saying, of trying to axiomatize not just ordinary quantum field theory, but then topological quantum field theory, right? And string theory leads to other approaches as well.
I have a comment also myself. So I want to say that I'm very, very happy that you brought this Euclidean program and also other Schroeder axioms into the scope of discussions. We had those, a lot of discussions, various explanations on the way. And I personally very like this comparison, and I just draw the opposite conclusions. And in my
good, case, I was hoping somebody had a different
so intuition. Actually, my intuition is that there was not only Osevaldo-Schadro that assumes at the time. Okay, so let's assume that we don't want to get like full gauge theory, and we are accepting Whiteman axioms or like some well done mathematical model of QFT. And then there was not only Osevaldo-Schadro axiomatics; there was also some axioms provided by Nelson. And imagine that these days, right now, we are trying to do quantum mechanics, and we're trying to provide interesting axioms for quantum mechanics. But the mathematical structure of quantum mechanics is not doable in finite dimensions. And it's not just matrices with complex numbers, after all, with additional structure that is like basically axiomatized by all approaches, but actually have like very dirty functional analysis. And in order to construct actually predictive models, you would have to put a lot of efforts and inside maybe some witty tricks. And I think that actually this program of trying to use this connection between Euclidean and Lorentzian formulations and think of Lorentzian QFT as actually probability theory over Euclidean space and trying to bring some axioms is not very, very far conceptually from this what is done right now with quantum mechanics. Just the framework is functional analytic, is much harder and is essentially connected with some spatial temporality, which doesn't happen in quantum mechanics per se. So I think that like my conclusion is that, well, those attempts didn't work at it so far, and maybe there are very profound reasons for this, which maybe we can learn in the future. But I think that like we are actually lucky that it's possible to do reasonable finite dimensional quantum mechanics, so it can be easily axiomatized in so many ways. But the fact that actually they were provided at least two different axiomatizations for the same set of Whiteman axioms, and there's also Hartkopf's theorem and so on, I think it's also something that says that there were different ways of thinking that make more probabilistic ways.
Yes, actually, just to follow up on that. So Nelson's actually was the first one who was able to prove a reconstruction theorem like this, and he used stochastic differential equations and imposed those kinds of constraints on the Euclidean fields. It turned out that if you wanted to build models, finding sets of functions and fields and whatever that satisfied those constraints was really hard to do. So this was the way that was more successful. But then that just gets back to one of the points I was making, which is that the motivations for this program were to construct models, right? If you're looking at this program from the point of view of interest in reconstruction for the purposes of understanding quantum theory, that's not probably your primary interest, right? So the more different kinds of ways of representing the same kind of formalism, the better, right? And maybe the more insight you can get, even if it doesn't turn out to be or hasn't been successfully used yet, it might give you an idea about how to connect things up.
Okay. If there are no more comments, then thanks very much. Let's have 12.
Yeah, so Stephanie, please come in. So time to find someone who has...
So you have probably received some emails from Stephanie.
Yeah.
In the time, so
yes. So
without Stephanie, this conference would never have come together.
Yeah.
That's been a complete mess. Yeah, she has been responsible, of course, for all the administrative parts.
And you
can
come on to the front.
Yes. And,
thank you. Okay.
And also,
strictly behind the scenes. So.
But actually, this is a time for having this.
Okay.
Yeah, so she also reminded us of what we have to do. Of course, we're always late. And, yeah, so thank you very much.
Thank you.